From the American Tobacco Historic District, this is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stasio.
See the mountain range? It comes all the way around till up here at this gap. Then it comes on around, and there's another gap over here. And that through that gap was where my mother and dad lived, right through that gap over there. Then it comes on.
Mary Jane Queen has lived in the mountains of Jackson County, North Carolina, for all of her 91 years. And for most of that time, she's been singing ballads passed down from Scots-Irish who settled that region in the 1700s.
I met a charming chap one day who loved me dear as life. I thought the time would surely come when I would be his wife. When I would be his wife. When I would be his wife. I thought the time would surely come when I would be his wife.
That ballad singing earned Mary Jane Queen a North Carolina Folk Heritage Award. And the North Carolina Folklore Society honored the Queen family, which includes Mary Jane Queen and her 8 adult children, with its Brown Hudson Award for keeping alive a tradition of music in the region. Now the Queen family is the subject of a new documentary. The documentary will have its first public screening tonight at Quail Ridge Books and Music in Raleigh. Joining me in the studio are the film's director, Neil Hutchison, and its executive producer, North Carolina State linguist, Walt Wolfram. Gentlemen, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
And joining me by phone from her home in Caney Fork section of Jackson County is the film star, Mary Jane Queen. Mary Jane, welcome.
Thank you.
Where did you learn the ballad we just heard? That's Little Black Mustache, right?
Yes, sir. I learned that when I was a little girl at home.
About how old were you?
About 12, maybe 10 or 12.
Yeah, and that was something that your parents sang, your mom and dad?
My dad.
Yeah.
My dad was a banjo player, and he sang every song nearly that he played.
Tell us more about your family. I know you were born Mary Jane Prince in 1914, then you married Claude Queen in 1935, and the Prince and Queen families were known for their musical abilities. Tell us about your families.
Well, as far back as I can remember, my dad always played the banjo, and he always sang nearly every song that he ever played. My whole family sang.
Singing all the time, and you also learned to play the banjo and the guitar, is that right?
Yes, sir.
And who taught you that? Still your dad?
Well, not really. I just took it up by watching him play and listening to him play. I just loved the banjo from a little girl up.
Neil Hutchison, how did you find out about the Queen family and what got you started putting this movie together?
Well, he was over in Maggie Valley, and this lady by name was Upter Church, and she came with him over here the first time I ever met him.
Mm-hmm. And Neil, how did you find out about this?
Well, Walt and I were producing a program called Mountain Talk, which was on Appalachian culture and dialect. And I'd heard about Mary Jane Queen, that she sang the old ballad, so I went for a visit. And that was kind of how it got started. That was about 5 or 6 years ago now. And at the time when I was doing Mountain Talk, I really had the feeling that I was documenting a culture that was fading away, you know, fading from view. And when I got to the Queen House and visited with them for a while and listened to them sing, and before I had recorded anything, I just felt, so excited because here was a place where that Appalachian heritage was just so vibrant and robust and real and present.
Walt, you have spent most of your career working with the spoken word. What got you onto the music?
Well, it's connected. I mean, it's difficult to say, well, this is just about how you speak. I mean, speaking is a part of culture. And so when you start listening to people speak, you start listening to them sing. You also see how they live. So that's why we're called the North Carolina Language and Life Project. You really can't separate language from life because it embodies the life, the language, and all other cultural traditions.
Mary Jane, that seems so true. It's part of life. Singing for you and your family, clearly, after watching this documentary, was a part of your life. When did you become aware that it was something unique and something that other people found interesting?
Well, when I was growing up, we always went to church and always helped to sing in the choir. And, I just had the feeling that that was part of life.
Do you, when I see a film like this and you see a wonderfully talented family like yours, and we're going to hear some more music in just a minute or two, you get the feeling that everybody up in the mountains is singing and picking and having a good time. Now, tell me the truth, Mary Jane. Are there some families that just have tin ears and can't sing a note?
Yes, sir. There are plenty of them that can't.
That's the documentary I want to see, Neil. I'm waiting for that one. So everybody kind of specializes, huh? And you just happen to be the musical families.
Well, yes, I tell people that it's a God gift to all my family.
And you've shared it with us. You and your husband and 8 children and the tradition continue. I'd like to hear a clip from the film, The Queen Family, talking about some of their musical memories. It starts with the voice of your daughter, Jeanette.
Yes.
Probably my very favorite childhood memory as a little girl was whenever we would all pile in the back of Daddy's old pickup truck and we would drive across the mountain and go over where my Grandpa Prince and Grandma lived. Before we'd ever get to Grandma and Grandpa's house, we could hear them singing.
We used to go over there almost like every Saturday night. They'd pick and sing. It'd start about 7 o'clock, quit sometime in the morning, play all night. I'll just jump in here somewhere. It don't matter where I'm.
Just jumping over here. We're all
I'm just going to sing.
Gather around.
When the family all together there around Grandpa's and me, well, I was picking and singing that old time mountain way. Well, although Grandpa's gone, his music's deep within me. Singing in my memory like only yesterday. He sang the blues.
And that's your son, Henry. He's very involved
yes,
in the music. Tell us about him and where else he plays and where else we can hear the music.
Well, we have played a lot of different places. We have played over at Warren Wilson College, Henry and I have, for about 7 or 8 years. We have played in Greensboro. We have played in Asheville at the Folk and Dance Festival, I guess 12 or 15 years. And we have played at Mountain Heritage. They said about 18 years. So we have played many places. I have played at...
You're still playing around in the area. Do you get outside the hills very, very much?
Well, once in a while, we get outside. It's been, about maybe 2 years since Henry and I went to... Greensboro. We went to
You get around, and I'm glad to have you on this show and do some of the music that you've done. I want to ask Walt Wolfram a question about his research, because Walt, I know you work on Appalachian dialects and what we sometimes refer to as mountain speech. What are some of the characteristics that we hear from that part of the state?
Well, there are a number of things that go back to older forms of English and also some new things. So, for example, one of the things you heard Mary Jane say was the of form, as he's a hunting and a fishing or something like that. Then you'll sometimes hear the H on it, so you get hits nice out and so forth. And then the part of speech, the I vowel. So, for example, as in waff and so forth for wife, which is something characteristic. It's characteristic of Southern speech, but it's a little different in Appalachia. So it's just full of features, some of which go back to Scotch-Irish, some of which are simply retentions of older English, and some of which are creations.
How much of that would we still hear back in the British Isles?
Not that much of it. It's changed in the British Isles, and it goes back to 150, 200 years.
One of the more interesting things to me is how these things do change in their native place, that these speech patterns tend to change in their later native place. And is it true that they are tend to be conserved better when they move? They change less?
Well, when you have enclave communities, communities that are isolated because of social, topographical, or separated from communication, you can have two effects. One, they can preserve older things that may change in other communities. By the same token, you can also have things that change rather rapidly and just take place within the community.
Mary Jane, we've heard some ballads, and we know a lot of them came from Scotland and Ireland. Do you have a sense that some of the songs were written in the hills and were written about your family?
Well, yes, they were. And my son, well, sang that a while ago about his grandpa. And then my grandson wrote a song about my husband when he passed away.
No. So the tradition is really, in a lot of ways, still alive. It's the state of things today, talking about the language in North Carolina, how the Queen family of the Western Mountains has preserved their songs and phrases, with linguist Walt Wolfram, filmmaker Neil Hutchison, and Mary Jane Queen all with us. A little later, we'll take your calls at 877-962-9862. You're listening to The State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Let's hear a little more of Mary Jane Queen of the Queen family. This is Vincent Young.
One hot and sultry morning, the ground all covered in snow, I put my shoulder to my gun and hunting I did go, a-hunting I did go. I went up yon big river that runs beneath the hills, and there I spied a Vinson, the one I was bound to kill, the one I was bound to kill. And being underwater some 40 feet or more, I fired off my old gun like a cannon, it did roar, like a cannon, it did roar. I bent my gun a circle around that big hill, and out of 15 or 20, 10,000 I did kill.
This is the State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio, talking today about the language of North Carolina and its music. Walt Wolfram of NC State is with us, as is filmmaker Neil Hutchison and Mary Jane Queen, who is the subject of a documentary that Walt and Neil made about the Queen family and their life and language in Western North Carolina. We're taking your calls about language in the Tar Heel State, how it's changing, how it's preserved, what's different, what remains constant. Our number is 877-962-9862. Mary Jane, the film about your family shows your tin-roofed house with the porch and the picking parlor and the surrounding fields, mountains, and trees. And I would say it may not have changed very much since you were a child, has it?
No, sir, not very much. It's about the same, except in some of the fields is beginning to grow up.
So more wildlife, not less. That's an interesting phenomenon, something we don't experience much here in the city. Neil, and that last song that we heard just before the break, we heard a gun going off. Is that something the producers added in post?
No, sir. a cousin of mine lives up not very far from where I do, and I don't know what he was shooting at, but just as I was singing that song, he shot that.
Don't take it personally. I'm sure he was shooting at something else. It was.
I'm sure he was.
But it does lead to some questions about it. And I know this is a pretty difficult thing to get at, but the fact is, don't you think, Walt, let me start with you in terms of language, how much does geography and topography play in the formation of language and sound, the way people vocalize?
Well, it's not that geography and topography per se change language. It's just that they create an environment where communication networks become intense and you don't get outside networks. So historically, some of our most interesting and unique dialects are preserved in mountains, islands, and other places of physical and social detachment from mainstream.
Neil, we talked earlier, too, about the number of songs that are being created in the mountains. Is there a sort of a rich a body of music now that's still growing?
Yeah, as I could observe, I think so. Most of the songs were traditional and passed down, and I would say there's more interpretation of old songs than creation of new songs. Of course, Henry does write original music, and a number of the family members, like Mark, write some original songs. the end of our documentary Mountain Talk concludes with Henry's great song called Kalawee. But mostly it's traditional.
Mary Jane, the upshot of this film is that this is a wonderful cultural tradition and that it should be preserved. Are you worried that it's going to be lost?
Well, if it's not preserved now, I don't. They have been a lot of it already lost. And, of course, we call it mountain music because that's where we've heard it all of our lives, was here in the mountains. And but they have been a lot of it already lost.
Well, let me talk to you about that, Walt Wolfram, because in a sense, if you talk about the music evolving, it's organic. We heard it growing up. What happens when we become self-conscious about preserving it?
Well, I think if what you mean by self-conscious is, are there things that we can do to preserve it? I think that, films like this that Neil has produced, recordings of various types. I think that we're a lot more conscious about preserving our past now than perhaps we were 50 years ago, where the past was the past and why bother with it. But now there's a new concern for linking with our heritage, whether it's music, whether it's language, whether it's life. And so I think that that right now in North Carolina and some other places in the United States, there's a concerted effort to in fact preserve a lot of these traditions.
But can it, Neil, can it be preserved as a living tradition, or does it at some point become a museum piece?
Personally, I have to say it becomes a museum piece, and I think that was what I was so excited about in meeting the Queen family, was that I think everybody is looking for experiences that feel authentic and real, and here was something, in my home state. And I feel like a lot of times when we celebrate Appalachian culture, what we're celebrating is at several steps removed from the source of the tradition. And here was the source of the tradition alive and well, and we both felt like it really needed to be captured right now.
Let's go to the phones. Gail is on the line from Durham. Hi, Gail.
Hi.
You have a
How
question?
Are you?
Good, good. You have a question for us?
Yeah, Mary Jane, I saw you perform at Guilford College one time, and Etta Baker was also on the bill with you, and your son was also there with you, and it was just wonderful. I was wondering if you ever take an old tune and put your own words to it, or do you try to keep it preserved exactly the way you learned it? I was just wondering about that.
Well, my brother and I don't know where he learned the words, "I wish it was a single girl again." And my sister and I went down and visited him. They lived in High Point. And he sang the song for me, and he wanted to know if I still sang the old ballads. I said, "Yes, I do." So he sang it for me, and as we was coming back from down there, Carol McCoy took us down there, and she had a notepad in her car. She got that out and a pen. She wrote down the words. The three of us remembered all of the words, and I still sing that song that the two of us put together.
Thank you. Thanks, Gail. That answer your question? Let me ask you, talking about modifying or changing songs, do you get together and argue about songs not being the way it was? Oh, no, that's not it. It's this way. Do you try really hard to sing it the way it's been sung over and over, or do you have a certain license to bring your own style to it?
Well, Sheila Adams told me one time that I sing the old ballads to the tune that the people used to sing them by. But she said over in Madison County that they had changed a lot of the tunes.
What accounts for that kind of thing? Do you know, Wolf? Well, I want to call you Wolf. Walt Wolfram. What accounts for, in some places you might see more modification, in others not?
Well, part of it has to do with the dynamics of the community itself. Some communities are more attuned to presenting itself to outsiders. Some are more in contact with outsiders. Some have a stronger sense of tradition and preserving it. So a lot of it is related to the dynamics of the community itself.
Mary Jane, growing up, did you know these were old Scots-Irish songs, or did you think about that much? Did people talk about where they came from?
Well, after I began to sing them, I began to ask where they originated at, and I was told that the Scotch-Irish brought them over with them when they came to this country.
And do you feel that that it's important, we talked about whether or not it can be preserved, but how important is it to you that this music is preserved?
Well, I would love for them to be recorded, and right now, the younger generation don't know anything about the old mountain songs. They're the ones that's been handed down from generation to generation. And I think that it would be good to let them have something to listen to if they want to listen to it.
Neil, when these songs are, when this music is taken away from the culture where it was born, does it become something else?
Well, I'm not sure what you mean about taking away from the culture. I think that when you hear the Queen family play, they express the culture, and they express a lot of things that don't come through necessarily by reading the notes and the words. There's something in the sound that is so authentic to the culture that it, I hope we've done a good job of capturing that. And it's,
but it becomes a different kind of a thing. If you're singing songs that you remember your grandparents singing, that has one impact in terms of how it affects the culture and how it affects you personally, versus something that becomes your entree to another culture, the way you learn about it.
Right. Well, you know, if you look at the film, it's really, the overarching theme is really a meditation on how culture evolves over generations, that it lives on and transcends a lifespan. But that it evolves, and just looking at how it evolves. And
well, Mary Jane, before we let you go, I know that you've got a song. It's one of your favorites, and I'd love to ask you to sing it for us, even though it has to be over a telephone line. I'd still love for you to sing it. Is it William Riley?
Yes, sir.
Would you sing it for us?
Yes, sir. One morning in May, I had just walked out. The lilies, they were springing. The leaves had just put out. I met with my true love, sir. She gently kissed me. I said, my loving madam, won't you go away with me? My parents, they are not willing that I should go away. And neither do I know you, nor neither do you know me. My name is William Riley. That stands at your right hand, and are you not the fair lady they call a Polly Ann? Oh, rise up, William Riley, and go away with me. I mean to go with you and leave this country, forsake my father's dwellings, fine houses and rich land, and away goes William Riley and his darling Polly Ann. This lady, she was taken in Cincinnati town, and Riley, he was taken, bound down all to the ground, just like some thief or robber. Next morning, he was found for nothing but the stealing of his darling Polly Ann. In came this young lady's father, and this is the tale he told. He's robbed me off my silver, he's robbed me off my gold, besides the silver buckles. With him I have found, I'll have the life of Riley, if it costs 10,000 pounds. In came this young lady, fell down upon her knees. The fault is not in Riley, the blame all lies in me. For Riley did not steal them, I'll swear by all above, for I gave them to Riley as a token of my love. In came this young lawyer with courage very bold,
to hang a man for love, it is murder, don't you know? To hang a man for love, it is murder, can't you see? And away goes William Riley, for the judge has set him free. There is a ring among them, O'Reilly, you must wear, with diamonds all around it, and flattered with my hair. And when you wear it, Riley, wear it on your right hand, it'll make you think of me, love, when in some foreign land.
Mary Jane Queen, live from Johns Creek, North Carolina. That was wonderful. Thank you. Via telephone, too. When did you learn that song? That's the Ballad of William Riley.
It was back in 19 and early 20s.
Wow. I want to thank you so very much for being our guest today as the subject of a documentary, The Queen Family, and thanks for joining us today on The State of Things.
Thank you, sir.
Walt Wolfram is still with us, and the director of the documentary, Neil Hutchison, is still here to talk a little bit about this work and some of the other work that you're doing, Walt. But one question about the ballads themselves. It does seem that in the Scots-Irish tradition, the story, the narrative as part of a song is a very strong tradition. Do other cultures have this? Is that such an important part of the storytelling tradition in other cultures?
Well, everybody has a narrative,
yeah.
And I think that music tends to embody it. So in that sense, I think it's probably fairly characteristic of what we do with narratives and language and song.
But for some reason, these are the ones that we remember in the tradition that carries on. I suppose one of the reasons is that they're carried on in English, and that helps us all. But let's talk about some of your other work, too, Walt. You're studying dialects of African Americans in three different places in North Carolina. You've got Roanoke Island in the Outer Banks, Princeville in eastern North Carolina, and Texana in the mountains. What are you hoping to learn? Tell us about the project.
Well, we're trying to learn about the history of African American English and how it's changed over the last century or century and a half. And what we're trying to do is look at different historically isolated communities. So, for example, if you look at African Americans who've been on the Outer Banks since the first decade of the 1700s, what does their speech sound like? Does it sound regional? Does it sound like urban African American speech today? And then you compare that with Appalachia, and then you compare it with, say, for example, with Princeville, which is a historically black community in the coastal plain area. You get an idea of what African American speech was unified by earlier and how it has changed over the last century and a half.
And you brought along some samples from the Outer Banks. Let's take a listen. The first one we're going to hear, and this is how it's changed over generations in the Outer Banks. The first one, I believe, is going to be an older African American man from the Outer Banks who sounds to me like a classic hoity-toiter. Let's listen.
We was young feller and got to fighting. I hit him lick or two, and he run to the shelter to get an axe, and I knowed what was in there when he went there, and a notion struck me, you better get behind the shelter.
And all right,
when he come out, he's looking for me where he left me.
This does not sound what to my ear would be traditionally an African American accent.
No,
in North Carolina.
No, and actually one of the things that we have found is that historically African-American English was much more regionalized than it is today. A really strange social phenomenon in terms of, for example, 150 years ago, African-Americans tended to sound a lot more like the region where they lived. Today, there's a sort of trans-regional trend where African-American speech has been tied in with African-American identity, and so one of the changes that's taken place over the generations is that it's loosed itself from its regional roots.
Well, let's take a listen to his great-granddaughter. We just heard that example from the Outer Banks. Here's his great-granddaughter who lives not far away.
Well, we started on that end.
I don't think that we're gonna try to find it.
He was sitting in the middle. Yep. We had him in between us because he was talking junk to these about 15 big guys and stuff, and they didn't like it. So, and when we were riding, he was just sitting there hitting stuff. He was bleeding and everything.
So that's how you ended up jumping a curb.
Well, It's like a U thing. It's the waterfront.
So that's an example of what you're talking about.
That's an example of a cohort of the young granddaughters. Young white from that area sounds like today. Now, if you play the sample of his great-granddaughter, you'll see how she sounds quite different from that speaker and sounds much more urban.
We're going to try to find that and have some other examples in the program. But ordinarily, we do tie the idea of speech and accent to regions, to various regions. And even among those who identify themselves as white, you sound like where you came from most often. But there is this phenomenon then in culture where identity can cross regional boundaries and the speech patterns comply.
Yeah, and actually today, ethnic identity has become as important, if not more important, than regional identity. And so to lots of young urban African Americans, they don't want to sound regional. They want to sound black. As a matter of fact, there was a study done in Washington, D.C. about the construct of acting white. And kids were asked in an inner city high school, like, what are the attributes of sounding white? And the number one item that was mentioned was talking white. So that speech has become associated with African American cultural identity. That wasn't the case 100 years ago, 150 years ago. People simply talk like the people around them. But today, it's become much more associated with African-American culture.
Well, we'll talk a little bit more about that as our conversation continues and invite your phone calls. What is it about speech that identifies you? Have you had to lose some characteristics of speech as you move around the country? Have you adopted characteristics? We're talking with Walt Wolfram today and Neil Hutchison, documentary filmmaker. Walt Wolfram is a linguist. We hope to hear from you. Give us a call at 877-962-9862. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stacio, talking this hour about language and dialect in North Carolina, how it's handed down, preserved, transformed, lost, and changed. And with me in the studio is Walt Wolfram, director of the North Carolina Language and Literacy Project and professor of English and Linguistics at NC State. Documentary filmmaker Neil Hutchison is with us as well. And we're taking your calls at 877-962-9862. Are there words or phrases that you grew up with that have disappeared? Do you purposely unlearn some words or phrases when you go to college or move to a different place in the state, different part of the country? Want to hear from you, your language experiences around the state and around the country at 877-962-9862. In an earlier project, Walt, you and Neil worked on Mountain Talk and suggested that that dialects can actually change from cove to cove.
Yeah, there is some transition from region to region. Most people just hear Appalachian English, or most people just hear Outer Banks English. But to folks who actually live there, there are little nuances. So, you know, maybe it's one little pronunciation, or maybe it's a few words that are endemic to an area that actually said holler from holler and island from island, even though to those of us who live on the mainland and in the Piedmont, they all sound like Appalachian or Outer Banksian. Right.
Now, tell us, you were telling us a little bit about the projects you're working on, and we worked from Roanoke Island. Now you also are looking at Texana. Tell us about Texana.
Right. Well, what we're interested in doing is looking at the development of African-American English. And so we are looking at different communities in different dialect contexts. So, for example, Texana in the Smoky Mountains is the largest African-American community in the Smoky Mountains, about 150. And so the question there is, do they primarily speak Appalachian English? Do they speak more African-American urban English? And so the question of our change over time, our trajectories, as we call them in linguistics, is really informed by looking at these different isolated situations. So Roanoke Island, down on the Outer Banks, Texana on the western part of the state, or Princeville, which is historically self-contained African American community.
And these areas have very interesting histories. Roanoke Island, which we know as the Lost Colony, also has another history that's less well-known, and maybe why it's part of your study.
Well, one of the reasons, and although everyone knows about the Lost Colony, people often don't know about what we refer to as the Forgotten Colony. The fact of the matter is that during the Civil War, a freedman's colony was set up on Roanoke Island, was self-contained, about 3,000-4,000 people. And then after the war, it was basically given back to the plantation owners. But about 150 to 200 African Americans stayed there. And so the question for us is, okay, so what's the language of this group? Does it sound like Outer Banks people? Does it sound like urban African American? And how does that compare, say, to the western part of the state and to other regions?
All right, let's go to the phones now. Greg is on the line from somewhere out there. Hi, Greg. I know, Greg, you talk, and we'll tell you where you're from.
Oh, okay. All right, I'm talking, so where am I from?
Oh, no, I can't do that. That's Walt's job.
Actually, Greg, I can do it in one word. It just takes me one word. If you pronounce the name of the place you're from, I can tell you where you're from.
Oh, okay. Well, I can do that. Now, I'm from Johnston County down in around Kenley, Smithfield, North Carolina.
Sure. Good Piedmont dialect.
Right, yeah. And we've often been told that we have a very distinct dialect from that group that lives there that might have originated from Britain.
Mm-hmm.
When some settlers came over. So I've always been interested to find out where that might be.
Where did this...
How to even research that.
Yeah, well, that's a good question. I mean, basically most of the people from in North Carolina didn't come directly from England, but actually came down from Jamestown. So
right.
There wasn't that much direct settlement. And the fact of the matter is that lots of the Jamestown settlers were from all over the place in mm-hmm. England, that they weren't quite this sort of one region to one region kind of confederation that people would like to think. So it's very difficult to tell where exactly in England people are from.
Okay, I understand.
Thanks for the call, Greg.
Okay, thank you.
What about, you know, you can study these kind of nearly pristine environments. People have been isolated for a long time, and then there's a change, so we can find out where they go and how the changes take place. Have you taken a look at urban settings where lots of different people mix and match and the impact that has on language?
Well, yeah, I mean, my original study of African American English started in a northern urban context. But of course, and so one of the fascinating things in these northern contexts 30 to 40 years ago was the fact that the residents were not picking up the regional dialect. So you'd have a black community in Detroit or Philadelphia, and they would not speak like the regional folks. And they became basically transplant communities of Southerners. And so that phenomenon, which is somewhat changing now, I mean, people are starting to pick up a few more regional nuances, was very different from the Southern context where it was very regionalized.
Let's go back to the phones. Vicki is on the line from Fayetteville. Hi, Vicki.
Hi, how are you?
Good.
I'm Colleen. I'm a military wife. I've lived all over the world in several different states. And so when I first was married, I had a very strong Western New York accent. And I think I've lost it.
Not all of it.
No, because Vicki, because you still have an accent.
Okay.
Yeah, but it sounds good, though. Go ahead.
Anyway, my question to you is, as a teacher, I'm concerned with the trends toward picking up urban black language for my students' achievement. I see with MTV and programs of this nature that they're promoting that type of language development, and how is this going to affect students later on when they enter the workforce?
Well, that's an interesting question. If we had the answer to that, we would probably solve a lot of our educational issues. Kids are expected to have standard English when they go to the workplace. By the same token, all of us have dialects that we use outside of the workplace, including myself, including Neil, and so forth. And so what we try to emphasize is the fact that we're all manipulators of language styles based on where we are, who we're talking to. And if we can communicate to some of our students the necessity of speaking standard in one situation and speaking another way, because as it turns out, peer influence is very strong on kids, and they're going to adapt to their peers. And so that's a fact of life. But if we can just get them to be bi-dialectal, if you will, then we would probably have solved that problem.
Thanks for your call, Vicki. Yeah, and it also points out something else, and that is that the sort of hip-hop language that we're talking about is working in all directions, not just black speak anymore. We're finding kids, white kids, who are picking it up because of peer pressure, that's how to sound.
Yeah, there's a whole field of study in social linguistics, which basically refers to linguistic crossing, in which white kids sound more urban because it sounds cool to them and they want to be hip-hop and you have to have that urban voice. And so and there are models, you know, of hip-hoppers who do that and so forth, Eminem.
And in terms of your sort of bilinguistics, and isn't it also true that we can talk a certain way among our peers and still be able to read, write, think in a more formal style?
Sure. No one really talks the way they write. I mean, and so the question is how flexible we are and how sensitive we are to the kinds of situations for our language manipulation.
Let's go back to the phones now. Elizabeth is on the line from Greenville. Hi, Elizabeth.
Hi, how are you guys doing today?
Well, good. I'm fine. How are you guys?
Great. Thank you.
We're good.
Good. I was calling because I like dialect and all the linguistic stuff, but I think that a factor that can be stronger than region and race can be class. My mom tells a story of when she was little, her family lived in Rocky Mount, but they moved to Spring Hope, which is kind of out in the county and more rural, and she went to school, and as you say, the peers affect you. And so she tried to say iron or fire or something the way they did. And as soon as it came out of her mouth, her dad looked at her and said, "We may live in the sticks, but you will not talk like you're from the sticks." And he was very serious about that. And I thought that was really interesting. And I wonder if you could talk some more about that.
Well, I mean, in every region, class and ethnicity seem to be operative. And that's certainly true in all parts of the South. By the same token, you know, what is upper class speech or middle class speech or working class speech in the South is very different from what it is in the North. And it also may differ from community to community. So it may be different for an African-American community and a white community.
Thanks for your call, Elizabeth. You know, it also raises questions about how quickly these change. And you went to Siler City to also get examples there. Tell us a little bit about your work
there. Well, the interesting thing about Siler City is that we have a new Latino community. So in 1990, there were less than 5% Latinos, and now there's a majority Latino community. So it's a rural area. So what happens to the kids in that community? So as they learn English, do they learn this sort of classroom English? Do they learn urban English? Do they learn rural Southern English? So the question of what kind of English models kids are learning becomes an important question in terms of our study.
So we have here a brother and sister from Siler City, both counting to 10. Let's listen.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. Okay, so what that emphasizes is the significance of who you choose to associate with. So you hear here are two kids, both of whom have lived the majority of their lives in Siler City. So why does the young girl sound so standard and the young gentleman sound so urban? You know, well, part of it is if you listen a little more to the interviews that we did with them, the girl is more acclimated to school, achievement in school, and the young man is defining himself as an athlete, as a macho, and part of his persona of toughness is not speaking standard, but adopting what sounds to outsiders as an urban African-American voice. So you hear him say, four, five, six, and seven. And so
all the way up to 10.
That's right, yeah. All the way up to 10. So just in the pronouncing of the numbers, you see drastic contrast between a brother and sister and how they choose to identify. And one of the things that's interesting about families, you may have people in the same family, some of whom sound very different from each other. You know, say, I can't believe you're brother and sister in the same family. And it's because of their choices, how they want to define themselves. And that's what we see in lots of these kids.
So it's a lot more fluid, I think, than we think it might be. Neil Hutchison is a documentary filmmaker. Are you surprised at the amount of interest there is in this kind of thing?
I guess it has surprised me. I've gotten used to it. But, I mean, after we did the documentary Mountain Talk, I mean, we received such an overwhelming response about it. It was so gratifying that there was so much interest in it, and they appreciated what we had done with it.
Let's go to the phones again. Jenny's on the line from Rocky Mount. Hi, Jenny.
Hi. Thank you all for talking to me.
Sure.
I'm from Rocky Mount, which is right near Princeton. And I went to school at UNC Asheville. And I'm a 20-something-year-old white girl. And while I was in school there, I got into it with a girl because she accused me of trying to talk black. And she was from up north. And I just wanted your take on that because to me, I sound like everybody around me.
Well, sometimes Southerners sound more black than Northerners, and so that may have been part of it. But you can also see the issues that come about. In other words, people may say, well, you're trying to sound black and you're not black. So there's that issue of a pretense or being a poser or something like that. But in reality, you see how important and how sensitive and how political issues of language are. It's not just a simple matter of language differences. They're all contextualized by what our society is and how it's developing.
Thank you for your call, Jenny. Has that always been the case, or is that just a phenomenon maybe promoted by and through mass media, electronic media?
Well, I think it's probably a bit more emphasized, but in reality, I think language has always been a proxy for behavior. You know, if you go back to the Bible, the difference between a shush sound and shibboleth or sibboleth would get somebody killed. So it's always been a proxy for other kinds of behaviors. But of course, with the media, it becomes a much bigger play and much more distributed in terms of the American public.
I guess it's more easy to attach the
because you see all these people. It used to be that, gee, you'd run into someone who talked a little different. But now, all over the media, you know, newscasters, people from different regions. And so we're exposed to much more diversity in language now.
One more call. Bill is on the line from Raleigh. Hi, Bill.
Yes, I went to school with a gal from up in Silva, North Carolina, and she used the term snunchwise and sagodwin-like, which I've never heard anywhere else in North Carolina. Are you familiar with those terms?
Well, there. I presume that's for crooked, right?
That's it.
There are a whole bunch of terms from sagodwin in the western part of the state to cattywampus on the Outer Banks to anygoglin and so forth. For some people, for some reason, people love to do dialectal things with crooked things. I don't know
what was that other one? What was that other one, Bill?
It's sagodwin-like.
Yeah, sagoglin-like is the one that is familiar, and Neil has documented in our Mountain Talk video. And on the Outer Banks, it's cattywampus, and then elsewhere, it's anygoglin.
Okay, Bill, thank you very much. We've got some other ones, too, now. You've got a jasper.
That's right.
Yeah, what's that now?
Neil?
Jasper, I believe that's somebody from outside the community. If you had a salesman come to the door up in the mountains, you might say, who's this Jasper come to see us?
And he might be trying to sell you a pig and a poke.
chances are he's not from the community if he's a Jasper. So.
And he's got a poke, which is, I guess, a sack of some kind. A sack in Iowa, the bag for the rest of you.
Everybody has terms for outsiders. That's really amazing. And it used to be on the Outer Banks that dingbatter, which actually was adopted from the Archie Bunker show originally. But now the most recent one is Touron, which is a blend between tourist and moron.
Oh, not like tourist, which could be a blend between tourist and terrorist, depending on whether you're in the White House or not.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, Walt, I wish we had more time and go through more of this language, but I thank you very much, Walt Wolfram, the director of the North Carolina Language and Literacy Project, also a professor of English linguistics at North Carolina State University, an executive producer of The Queen Family. Thank you very much.
Thanks for having us.
And Neil Hutchison is the director of that film and many others, and we appreciate your being with us as well. Neil?
Thank you. I enjoyed it.
Walt and Neil Hutchison will be at Quail Ridge Books and Music in Raleigh tonight, screening the DVD and leading a discussion about the movie. You can join them there. That's the state of things for today. Thank you for listening. Send us an email if you have a comment, sot@wunc.org. This is North Carolina Public Radio, broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stasio.